Welcome to the South Asian Studies at Stanford podcast, also known as the SAS Pod. I am Lalita Duperron, Associate Director in the Center for South Asia. All our podcasts and information about the center are available at southasia.stanford.edu. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Sohani Jalota. She holds an MBA from Stanford from 2022, and she's currently a PhD candidate as an economist studying labor. Her areas of interest are development and labor economics, with a particular focus on gender in poor households. Sohani, it's so nice to see you today. How are you?
Thanks so much for having me here, Lalita. I'm doing well. How about you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, me too.
Would you like to start introducing yourself? Tell us a little bit about your life before Stanford, then what led you to do the MBA, and then how did you end up doing the research that you're doing now?
Yeah, so I come from India. I'm from Mumbai, and I've traveled and lived in different cities and small towns all over Maharashtra. And most recently spent my high school years in Mumbai, which is the city of stark inequalities, right? That's the city where there's massive urban slum communities on the way to school, and the school can be in a very different type of a neighborhood. And so I think growing up, at first, there was a lot of just indifference and you didn't even realize what was happening. And then I think over time started to embed myself a lot more and understand when I met some girls exactly my age, but just living across the road in one of these urban slums, and started to get connected with many of the slum community leaders through them, and started to realize, this is when I was 15 years old, met these women who were so powerful and yet had lived and were living such tragic lives, where they couldn't see a different norm. And so somehow that angered me. I started off really as an activist, as a field social worker, and then as a social entrepreneur. We wanted to change the situation somehow and do it together. So I came for my undergrad to Duke, also with a similar kind of passion to change something and do something about it. Didn't know how. Went back to India after that and started an organization called the Mena Mahila Foundation, where Mena is the bird that speaks a lot. And Mahila means women in Hindi. And you want women to speak up about the issues they're most afraid to discuss aloud. So we, as an organization, have started doing a bunch of things, but really the focus was on increasing women's economic power and agency to be able to speak up. And to do that, there were two very core elements that they needed, which is both financial independence and destigmatizing taboos around women's bodies and health that were holding them back. So we can get into more details around this, but just generally, my life before Stanford was very heavily on the field in these urban slums with the most incredible, inspiring women in the world, who I've had the pleasure and opportunity to have worked with now for almost 15 years. And then I got to Stanford to really learn how to actually understand how to solve these problems that we'd been experiencing on the field, but where there's so many of them and you feel very helpless and you often feel like you're just not moving the needle enough. No matter what you do, it's still a drop in the ocean. So I really wanted to understand what were the root cause problems. I had qualitatively understood them, learned more, but didn't really have the technical skill set, I felt, to myself credibly be able to ask questions and understand how best to identify the answers. And so to me, Stanford and the PhD really started off in that journey of understanding how best to tackled some of these large daunting problems. And then the MBA was such a great, so I'm part of the Knight Hennessy Scholars Program, the first year of that, in fact. And so I was really convinced, I think, by many of my peers there to apply for the MBA in between, where it really seemed like a really good combination of both the entrepreneurial pursuit and having this research backing that the PhD was already able to provide. And so now going back to the PhD post the MBA, I'm just really feeling like it's coming this full circle where we're able to implement some of the work that we're doing, that we were doing in much smaller scale on the field before Stanford, and have had a much stronger understanding. I don't think we have the answer yet, but I think I have a much stronger sense of what the answers could look like and be on that path to getting there as part of what I do now and next.
This is amazing. Thank you so much. I already want to talk to you for the next 4 hours. Podcast audience, fear not. We will not, at least not while recording is going on. So really your aim is to was to dismantle capitalism and the patriarchy together is what I'm hearing you say. What was it like doing an MBA? I mean, I think for many listeners, doing an MBA at Stanford, we think of people that are going to go into the startup world. We're in Silicon Valley. These are people that want to make money. And an MBA at Stanford is, for many people, a great place to start. You're not interested in that. You want to solve problems, address issues. How did that feel? And was it, I mean, it's sure it was helpful. You're already saying that, but did you feel a little like the odd one out, or are there lots of people with this kind of mindset of social justice? Yeah, you're nodding.
Yeah, nodding to a lot of the things that you were saying, I'm definitely not the only one. There were a few of us, I think, who felt similarly, but definitely a huge minority. And there are socially minded people, but I think that there needs to be so much more of this because we were interacting with people we normally would never have. I truly don't think I had met my classmates or people like my classmates in any other type of work that I'd done in the past. I think it's helpful and important to understand the people on the other side of the table, those usually writing the checks, those usually in control of all of the money that in the social impact sector we tend to be beholden to understand where they come from, what their mindset is like, what kinds of things are they thinking about that are important to them. And that helps us even understand how best to appeal. And this is not just in terms of philanthropy, I think, but also in terms of understanding there are so many things to share between sectors. And there's so many learnings that I think we've had. How do you make money is important actually for everyone, and particularly the poor, and particularly those that have not had access to those kinds of opportunities to understand how best to do that. And those are exactly the people who are being excluded from these very capitalistic conversations that they could benefit the most from. So we need to be in those rooms so that we can provide the sort of bridge between these two worlds that are often not connected at all. So I think in many ways, I don't think that the MBA again like has helped me do this perfectly, but has definitely helped open my mind to imagining a world that I truly had not seen before. And I think being in the Valley has definitely, it continues to be opening my mind every day with more and like just larger and larger numbers or different types of people working on completely different things. But the PhD was often a grounding force, as often the MBA tends to be a little bit distracting. And there's often, it seems like anything is possible. And particularly the Stanford GSB is like, you can do all kinds of things. It can really pull you in different directions. But the PhD grounds you in that, hey, but what was the focus again? Like, it has to be a really narrow focus for you to actually change the situation, even for a small set of people. So instead of dreaming so big and thinking about these broader problems about changing the world, let's start with something really specific that is actually like you can actually transform and measure the change. So I think that the combination, in fact, I wonder why more people don't do it, but I think the combination can work really well for people who want to be both change makers, implementers, and thinkers.
And the combination, you mean the MBA and the
And the
PhD?
PhD.
Okay, so tell us more, but then about the PhD. What is it that you were focused on? Can you give us like some examples?
Yeah, so in the PhD do you mean the combination or you mean
The
the PhD?
PhD itself, like post MBA.
Yeah, so the PhD work that I'm doing is really focused on providing or understanding what are the constraints that are holding women back. More generally, when it comes to women's agency, that is the ability to make decisions or choose between multiple options, women's economic power. So, what's really constraining women? And often, in the context that I study, which is South Asia, it tends to be some or the other reason that's intertwined with social norms or gender norms. Now, gender norms is a very broad idea, and it's again, it's very difficult to understand what about the norm, which norm, and how can we actually shift norms if we don't understand which norm we're actually trying to change. And so this the work that I was doing as part of my PhD was really trying to dismantle and understand, well, what norm, if truly women in South Asia are being held back, where we see female labor force participation rates to be much lower than even other developing countries around the world, there's something specific about the norms here that are not present potentially in other areas. And so something that that became very apparent from the national sample survey that we found in the 2019 data that came out, we see in India from the Time Use surveys, that women that were not employed were not even leaving their homes even once a day. And this is happening in urban India. And so seeing these sorts of statistics, and you realize, well, there needs to be, I think there's something in common here, which is maybe the norm that women are not allowed to leave home. And could that be contributing towards this? Again, I'm happy to now go into the research exactly, but this
Go
was
for it.
essentially the premise of the PhD, the sort of the quest that I was on was trying to figure out more and more what is this norm that's constraining women, how do we study it, and then what do we do to potentially change it? And so that was the next part of the PhD, and I spent a lot of time then, I think over the last 3 years or so, really working on that part and developing a platform that we felt could be a gateway to more permanent employment or further change.
So there's a research element. That's the question. What is the norm? What is the main? You're kind of trying to whittle it down, right? What is the one thing? And the answer seems to be that women are simply not leaving the home if they're not working. But presumably, even if they are working, it's not as if they can go off and do whatever they want. But then now you're also looking at solutions. And so what does that look like?
Yeah, so maybe I can explain a little bit about what the research study, my main paper, is really was really about, and then that'll help understand the interventions a little bit more as well. So I do experimental economics. So essentially, we run randomized control trials in the field, as that's often some of the cleanest ways of understanding the causal effects of the constraints that we're trying to study on actually constraining women's labor force participation, if they really are a big force in constraining those women. So what we are studying specifically here is, if you want to understand what is constraining women's work, we take all of the bundle of constraints that women might experience, which you can often imagine. I mean, some of the most quoted reasons that women often themselves state is, I have little kids, I don't know where to keep them, or so childcare of some sort is potentially a big constraint. Safety, particularly in the Indian context, comes up as a very often an issue, especially in terms of traveling and distance to work as well being too far. There's also time management, that the women are doing a lot of housework, other responsibilities, so they can't leave that. And there's also lack of information. Women don't know where to work. There's a good job opportunities, especially there at home. They don't have good networks. So we bundle these and we call all of these sort of surface level constraints and these practical constraints to women's work, some of which might be embedded in gender norms also, but they really are constraints that are maybe policy and amenable. So you can construct policies to solve some of these problems. So, for instance, for the childcare, you can provide childcare facilities. You can provide those childcare facilities right next to women's homes and provide women with work exactly in those same offices where the childcare is being provided. You can ensure that there's also safety at the workplace by ensuring only female co-workers and no males around, and so on. Now, we create these new offices. So we create 35 of these new female-friendly, ideal kind of scenario offices for women's work. And what we try to here understand is, well, even if we provide women with such offices, Can we now see that women that are not working, which is majority of women, about 80% of the women, can they now actually start working? Because we're controlling for and able to at least minimize a lot of these other barriers to women's work. But if there's something deeper at play, which is not these surface level constraints, there's something like the confinement to the home, then even after providing something like this right outside your house, within a 5-minute walking distance, maybe in your same building itself, then the women might not be able to work if it's these norm that is at play of confining women to the home. And so what we do is we create an experimental setup where we provide women with jobs that are over their own smartphones. These are digital jobs that we create called Rani Work. Rani means queen in Hindi. So the mobile application that women had to download was called Rani Work. And they worked on the same job tasks, both from home and from the local office. Now, women were randomly assigned to either one of the two locations. So they didn't know that there was an office available, or the office people did not know there was a home option available. So they was only assigned to either one of the two. And we also cross-randomized them into one of three different wage levels: a low wage, a medium wage, and a high wage, where the high wage is 25% higher than even the husband's monthly income. And the low wage is about $60 a month, medium is about $150, and the high is about $300 a month. So these are pretty significant wages. And the amount of work that women were doing a day was maybe about 2 hours. Very flexible at a time of the woman's choice between 10 to 6 p.m. from office, even from home. The app was frozen before 10 a.m. and after 6 p.m. So everything was basically standardized between home and office. Now, what do we find? We find that the take up of the jobs that are exactly the same from both the office and from home is double that from home than it is from the local office right next to your home. Even when you have no, your options are no job or the job from the office that is extremely female friendly with only other women, with childcare provided and everything, and right next to your home. And we also find that our results by wages is that no matter what you pay the woman, the $60 a month or $300 a month, it doesn't seem to matter in take up. Now, when we run the same experiment with wives, the husbands in the same married households, and this is a study that we did with 3,200 married households in Mumbai urban slum resettlement communities. When we also do this experiment with the husbands, we find that husbands are highly sensitive to wages. So they have double the take up at high wages of the exact same job type, the same smartphone-based job application, but that for them, location doesn't really matter. So between the home or office, wherever they're provided, the take up is about the same. And then we run a subsequent set of another experiment where we try to understand, well, what is it about the home? You might think sometimes that maybe just home is more comfortable, more convenient, and maybe that's why it's not really the norm. It may be just be the convenience of doing this. But when we look at the husband results, we might think that for the husbands too, the comfort and inconvenience could also be at play. But in this context, it did not seem to be the case. So it seems to be a gender difference. And when we look at by whether or not women have young children, could it just be that women can't leave their children behind at home, and that's why, and they can't, for some reason, they don't feel comfortable with the childcare provided at the office? We find that, in fact, there is no difference in take up between women that have young children and don't have young children for take up from the office. Similarly, for elderly caregiving responsibilities as well. For women that have elderly caregiving responsibilities and those that don't, we in fact see that there's a higher take up of office-based jobs for those that have more elderly caregiving responsibilities. And oftentimes it's because you want to escape your in-laws and you want to be in the office for longer. And so this large difference between the take up from home and office really can't be explained by this inconvenience or discomfort. It can't really be explained by caregiving responsibilities that women have. And it really seems to me from the mechanism experiment that we do, that I understand I've already spoken a lot about this, so I won't get into the details of the other experiment, but we also add additional variations to work from home in another experiment where we condition on, even if you're working from home, you cannot multitask along with other housework, whether or not that affects take up. We also add another condition where you're working from home, but you have to step out of the house for 2 minutes a day, check in at the local office, and then come home and work from home to check for job observability. Is it the fact that you can hide the work That's what's confining you to the home. And we find that that actually seems to drive a lot more of this gap between home and office. It seems to explain that. And in fact, the households that are less likely to accept that particular job observable arm are the ones that are coming from less progressive households almost entirely. So those that are ranking low on the social norm index in our survey. We have a bunch of other qualitative results that also point to similar results, showing that it's really the confinement to the home that can drive this huge gap, with the main result that's policy implied from our study really being that even many of the policy amenable solutions, unfortunately, may not be able to close or even come close to closing the gender gap in female labor force participation in a context like India, where the confinement to the home or these domesticity constraints may be so strong that home-based jobs may be the most immediate path to closing the gender gap in India.
So this is all absolutely fascinating. I have so many questions. Let me start with one about when you say that there's various data that you use. Is there do you see that the focus when you say less progressive homes, the focus on female confinement is stronger in less progressive homes? Is there any data on caste or religion in that, or is it more broad? Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, so by progressive, we actually created an index that is using injunctive norms, which are essentially the idea of whether or not women think that other women in their community think that women should work, whether or not women in their community think that she should work herself, whether other men in the community should think, and so on. So these are kinds of perceptions that women might have. The progressiveness index does seem to be correlated with religion. And in our context, we do find differences in women's job results by religion, not necessarily at take up, which actually we were surprised by, because in many of the Muslim households, in at least the context that we study, are even more restricted from leaving their homes, especially after marriage, especially after even puberty. But in our data set, we actually find that the take-up results were the same between both the Hindu and Muslim women, but the dropout rates were vastly different. And so it seems that women may not have had discussions with their husbands before they started the work to even know whether or not they might be allowed. And they had their own beliefs about whether or not they might be allowed to work, especially if the work is so convenient, it's from home or next to home. Maybe women assumed that they may be allowed in ways that they then had to update based on what happened when their husbands might have stopped them from working. So Muslim women were 30% more likely to drop out, both from the office and from home, although it was slightly higher from the office. And then actually in the round two, when we provide women with jobs again, Muslim women are less likely to take up the work than Hindu women because it seems that their beliefs are probably updated now. By caste, we do not find any differences in our sample. Now, the context that we are studying is Mumbai urban slum communities, where there is a diversity of types of people from all over India. But maybe certain, like maybe the caste system is not as prominent or strong in enforcing some of the labor constraints.
Yeah, okay, great. Thank you so much for clarifying that. And then can you speak a little bit? I'm sure you could talk about this for hours. We don't have that, but can you speak a little bit to all the behind the scenes work? So you have to find 3,200 families that are somehow willing to work with this. You have to explain this to them. Presumably that's mainly verbally. You have to get some kind of agreement that they know what they're signing up for, presumably also verbally. An app was created called Rani Work. Is it on the App Store? Can we go look at it? Like, how many people and how much time goes into that? I mean, it's incredible.
So 4 years, about 75 plus people in our team doing this. So it was a lot of hard work, I think, and a lot of money, a lot of different supporters and people who really came and made this project happen. And this was during COVID, that we were really getting things rolling, and the whole app development and everything happened during that time. Pilots we did with 500 women and then had to find these women. But we used for sampling, we used a government provided a data set of all the slum redevelopment communities all across the city of Mumbai. We then chose a random set of a few communities where we then listed more than 30,000 households. So that is basically our surveyors going door to door to every single house in a certain building, and then identifying whether or not they're eligible to meet our eligibility criteria for our study. So women had to be married to be a part of our sample. They had to be between the ages of 18 to 45. They had to own a smartphone because that was necessary as part of for this work. They had to also complete two out of the three tasks correctly that we gave to them. That was very similar to the type of tasks that we provided on the platform, and so on. So there was a lot of this screening that had to happen, but so much of that was made simpler because we had community trust already built, given the nonprofit, the Mena Mahela Foundation, was already there and had been doing this work for so many years before that. That trust had been built, so we don't have to go in and talk to people who are very skeptical of who are you coming in and giving us a job at the doorstep. Like, this seems too good to be true. I'll report you to the police. These are things that often actually happen, which is very, very real in these kinds of communities. And the app that we built is actually part of a new initiative on providing and understanding what is the future of work opportunities for aspirational young women, given that the middle skilled, those that have completed 8th grade, 10th grade, 12th grade, and no more education and or no less, like these are the women that are in fact the majority of the population today as more and more girls' education is being promoted in India. But that translation to employment does not happen. And that gap is what we felt that this RaniWork type of a platform could really help fill, which is the middle skilled women can get to do white collar work conveniently using their existing devices.
It seems to be there's an enormous opportunity here because I mean, everything's online now and everybody's got a smartphone, and so this feels really kind of visionary work you're doing. Tell me more about the Mena Mahela Foundation, and you mentioned that all of this work you're doing is really just to understand how you can do that work better. So how are you going to do it better?
Yeah, big questions. I think that ultimately we want to enable systems to shift such that we can shift mindsets around norms around gender equality in India. That is very ambitious and very long term and probably involves very complex interventions and research that we need to be able to fuel that to happen. So the research that we're doing now is really trying to understand specifically in the women's workspace, what are interventions that we can use that are complying with existing norms first so that we can get women to work at all. Can that now then shift the norms? So that's the next step. So right now we've provided women with the short-term sort of work where we're trying out whether or not women would even take it up. We see that yes, and like women are taking this up much more than what we'd have anticipated. And if more than half the women currently unemployed are able to start doing this work from home, that's huge. But now, can we keep that going for longer periods of time? And can women actually be retained or not? And now, does that shift their own attitudes towards women's work? Or does that still make her feel like a housewife or a homemaker? And does that not actually shift the attitudes? Because if that doesn't change, then we need to find other interventions. And maybe this is not a direct path towards that agency shift. And does that also shift the attitudes of other family members in the household as well? Because it's incredibly important for this to happen. So I think, yeah, so I think this is all step by step. At Mena Mahela Foundation, which was your question, like, what do we do and how are we growing this? So Mena Mahela has three arms. We focus on women's health under Mena Health, and then we have Mena Employ, under which Rani comes in, and then we have Mena Research, which is the more research and innovation arm, where a lot of the pilots and experiments, the randomized control trial, the data collection agency that we had to build to make all of this happen was all under that. Mena Health, in fact, does a lot of work on sexual and reproductive health of women, both providing physical interventions, as well as providing women with digital interventions to help open up. So the whole rise of AI and GPT and the OpenAI foundational models have really helped us, and we have partnered with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to essentially now we've developed this new bot called Mena Bolo that helps women provide them with personalized, non-judgmental information that's medically accurate about family planning, particularly as we find that in these communities, women actually don't have any other source of such information. Now, where this ties into the research is that we need to understand if these kinds of systems are actually any better than a telehealth provider or than providing a direct female doctor in person kind of a contact. Or is this more scalable solution actually good enough? And what is good enough? Have we actually been able to shift family planning practices or not? So those are kinds of tests that we're going to be doing now to see whether is this something that we can now take to the government to help scale along with the Gates Foundation.
When you say this is something that we're looking at now, tell us what you are going to be doing next. You are completing your PhD, you have some plans in the future. Please share those and then, tell us a little bit more about what the next few years look like for you and for the Mena Mahila Foundation.
Yeah, thanks. So next, I will actually continue to be at Stanford at the
It's good news alert.
I'll continue to be at the so I'll be joining the Hoover Institution as a Hoover Fellow for the next few years. And the idea is to be able to continue doing my research that I'm doing on female labor force participation in India and understanding how we can scale some of the work that we've now proven really seems to work at the pilot stage, but now finding a lot more private sector employers to join in and provide work continuously and more sustainably to women. So what does that look like? How can we get employers to join in? What are the considerations on productivity and efficiency and cost and things like that that would matter to them that we now need to consider are things that I'm going to be working a lot more on over the next few years and hopefully also bring in a lot of different stakeholders, including private sector, but philanthropy, civil society organizations, and academics together to understand what the future of work for women actually would look like in contexts where norms have constrained women traditionally. But now that we see more than 90 or even 100 million more women able to enter the workforce around the world, how are we actually going to serve their needs? How do we actually create and provide those jobs for them that are needed in the future? So I think those are the big questions I want to be, probably not in the next few years, probably in the next 10 years or longer. But we're actually hosting a Future of Work for Women summit possibly next year, and would love for the community here to also be a part of that in any way possible, because it's again an attempt to try to get all these different stakeholders together in one table and build alliances and form commitments to solving these issues.
I love that. I love this the plug. Also, so many congratulations on your work and this really great success story. Audience, if you want to find out more about the conference or the workshop that may be happening later this year, go to southasia.stanford.edu, sign up for our mailing list. You can also connect with Sohani via social. Are you on social media?
I am on social media. Probably LinkedIn is good.
Okay, we'll link to LinkedIn in the show notes and then people can follow you. You can also follow me. I don't do very much on LinkedIn, but it's a good place to connect for sure, and also weed out some of the other algorithmic stuff that makes our life difficult. However, speaking of the algorithm, audience, please go to your podcast platform and rate and review the podcast, because that drives more audience members to the podcast, and we love for more people to listen to the podcast and find out about some of the incredible work that's happening at Stanford, as evidenced today by my guest, Sohani Jalota. Thank you so much for joining me. This was a really fantastic conversation, and congratulations on everything you've achieved and are about to achieve in the future.
Thank you so much, Lalita. Really a pleasure to be here.
I also want to thank Soham Shiva for the beautiful music and Manar Flevolkeniar for post-production.
चले भया के गुलशन का
Thank you for listening to the SASPOD, the South Asian Studies at Stanford podcast. Find out all about the Stanford Center for South Asia at southasia.stanford.edu and find us on social media. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you for joining us, and I hope you can tune in again soon. मकाम फैज़ कोई राह में जचा ही नहीं जो कुएं आरस निकले।